Physics World.
Hi, I'm Hamish Johnston, General Physics Editor of Physics World, and you are very welcome to this episode of our weekly podcast. Coming up, Physics World is in conversation with Amber Bannon, who is the president of the Society for Radiological Protection, and with Peter Bryant, who is the president-elect. And I'll also be talking to the newest member of the Physics World team. But first, here is James Dacey with some news.
Forests play a major role in drawing down and storing atmospheric carbon dioxide. An estimated 3/4 of the carbon stored on land is locked up in forest ecosystems. But when a tree experiences internal decay, it starts to release carbon back into the atmosphere. Current models of carbon sequestration don't directly account for this internal decay. Now, however, scientists in the US have developed a non-destructive way to measure the amount of decay inside a tree. Robert Mara from the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station and Nicholas Brazzi from the University of Massachusetts carried out tomographic scans on trees in the Great Mountain Forest in Connecticut. Using novel lightweight equipment, they generated internal profiles of 72 of the three most common hardwood tree species: American beech, sugar maple, and yellow birch. 39 of the trees were then felled, and the scientists compared the tomographic images with the relevant cross-sections of tree trunk to test the accuracy of the scanning technique in identifying internal rot. Mara says the results were quite a surprise, with decay occurring in a number of trees that showed no sign of external decay. Publishing their findings in Environmental Research Letters, the researchers argue that internal decay now needs to be incorporated into our carbon accounting models. Hadron therapy is a physics-based approach to treating cancer by targeting tumours with beams of proton or ions. The advantage of the technique over conventional forms of radiation therapy is the ability to dump the energy in a precise location while causing minimal damage to surrounding tissue. Unfortunately, the number of potential patients, some estimate 1.5 million per year at present, far outweighs the capacity of currently installed hadron therapy systems, which treat some 20,000 patients per year. One of the major obstacles in expanding the availability of hadron therapy is the vast size, weight, and cost of current instruments. Treatments require a beam to be delivered from different directions, and it's neither practical nor comfortable to move the patient any great amount, so this necessitates the use of either multiple beam lines or, more commonly, a rotating gantry. Such gantries are complex structures that represent a considerable fraction of an installation's cost and size. Now, a collaboration of scientists in Europe are developing an alternative approach to delivering the hadron beams. CERN researcher Luca Battura, along with PhD student Enrico Falsini and colleagues at EPFL in Switzerland, are working to create a lightweight and compact system called Gatoroid. The group's idea is to swap the rotating gantry for a toroidal magnetic field that could bend the particle's beam precisely at high speed. Battura and colleagues presented the project at the recent CERN Knowledge Transfer Seminar. The team is now halfway through a 3-year project. Last year, they started to work on the basic Gatoroid design, addressing issues such as magnet design and geometry, beam tracking, and the ability to paint a target, and then tackled the mechanical design. For progress on how the project develops in the future, keep an eye on the medical physics section of our website. Okay, thanks, Hamish. So back to you now for a conversation with our special guest.
Thanks, James. I'm very pleased to introduce the newest member of the Physics World team. That's Alex Petkov, who is doing a 6-week internship with us. Hi, Alex. Welcome to Physics World.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, Alex did a MPhys at Exeter University, and he's embarked on doing a PhD at the Center for Doctoral Training in Condensed Matter Physics, which is run by the universities of Bath and Bristol. Now, some of our listeners might not be familiar with Centers for Doctoral Training, or CDTs. Alex, how does the program work?
So this is a way for kind of improving on the process of creating PhD students, making people do this step, doctoral training. Normally, you would just go and do a specific research that you're interested in, either look at different proposed projects that scientists are having in different institutions, and you say, oh, I want to work on this project, I want to work on this bit of research. But this is usually really, really difficult because all these projects are not guaranteed to be funded. And introducing CDTs is actually a really good way of going around that. So you would have a bunch of academics who are working in this center, who have many different projects who will be funded by government bodies or other, and they would each year have a number of students who can pick and choose whichever projects out of all the ones that have been proposed and already funded, and then without any problems go on to doing their PhD. It's a really nice idea because on the one hand, you're guaranteed that you'll be working on this specific research, and also you'll be in a community with other academics and other students. So it feels very comfortable, very nice.
And it is interesting that, as far as I understand, when you first arrive, you pick up some general research skills, don't you? So you're not only working specifically on a project. I was speaking to you yesterday, and you mentioned that there are other skills that you learn. For example, how to design experiments in general, that sort of thing.
Yes, this is actually something that I've only seen in this specific CDT that I'm part of here, joint between Bath and Bristol. So most CDTs are quite general, so they have academics which propose projects which get funded and then students partake. In this current Center for Doctoral Training in Condensed Matter, this is actually part of the reason why I chose it. You have your whole first year exploring different areas in this very wide subject. A lot of people, like myself, do not know straight away what they want to do research in. We leave our undergrads with a very narrow view of physics and research, and it would be, you know, a bit silly, I think, to go into research continuing blind, not really knowing what is out there and what you actually might really take interest in. So the way that my first year is structured, there's a lot of taught elements, lectures, there's workshops, physics techniques, so you can get hands-on with some apparati, some specific measurement types. So you get to learn a lot of different things all throughout the subject. You get to do small bits of work, small bits of research, which lasts not long, like a few weeks. And also currently my internship with you guys is also part of my program. I have an industrial placement, so to say, which is also about building different skills in future scientists. And yeah, after a few months from now, I think I'll finally have got a good view of condensed matter physics, and I'll be able to choose my final project, what I'll actually be working on for the next few years.
And it's interesting. I mean, if you think of the old-fashioned way of doing it, I mean, I suppose this is how I did it. You sort of identify a topic and a researcher who's working on that topic, and they're probably at a university far away, and you might visit them once, and then suddenly you make this huge commitment. Yes, I will go and I will work on this specific project. And if it doesn't work out, then you could be in trouble. Where it sounds like with this way of doing things, it's almost an interview of the researchers themselves, isn't it? You can get to know these people, how they work, how their labs work, and you could use that as part of your decision making process.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I really love it. It's so good. I think it's definitely an improvement on the way PhDs used to be ran. And to be fair, all of the people that I know who have gone on to do PhDs have done so with a CDT. So a lot of my friends stayed in Exeter to work with academics that they've known for years as part of the Center for Doctoral Training, so they would also get guaranteed funding. And one of my other friends got into a PhD at Imperial due to connections, so he knew people who suggested a PhD to him. He wasn't really looking for one, but it's knowing the people, I think, which is really important. You don't want to work with someone for 3 years without knowing anything about them.
Mm. And you mentioned that you're here as part of this program, the internship that you're doing. What made you decide to do something in science journalism? Why did you choose us?
I think I've always been quite interested in writing. Also, whilst I do like science, I do sometimes take issue with the way research is being run. And it can be frustrating when things are not really working out and you have really good ideas, but they're just not plausible, or the way you have to go about them is very arduous. So in me doing my PhD, I was quite aware that I would probably not go into academia, and I wanted to try different avenues for using my scientific background, and that's why I chose something a bit different, not really working in conventional industry, but working in scientific publishing.
And you've only been with us for a couple of days, and you're already putting the finishing touches on a news story that you've written. So let's talk a bit about that. The research that you're describing is it's a way of incorporating disorder into a metamaterial in order to increase its strength. Now, a metamaterial is an engineered structure that's made of building blocks, and they're usually arranged in a regular lattice. But in this work, they're not doing that. They're introducing some disorder. Why is that, and why does it make things stronger in some cases?
Well, in reality, whilst we think of materials or crystals as an infinite periodic lattice, in reality, real materials like metals and alloys, which have a crystal structure, are polycrystalline. So they have little grains where the lattice is oriented in a certain direction. So there is a lot of disorder there, and they're not obviously perfect. The reason why this helps is, imagine if you have a crack propagating through your material and it reaches a boundary of a grain where the orientation of that is different, it will stop propagating. This is mostly because if you have your material, your crystalline material, it will not break because the bonds of the atoms break, but it will slide across different planes of the material, and if you have this disorder, then it makes the sliding a lot more difficult, and hence enhances the strength.
And of course, people have known this for years, haven't they? Well, for centuries, in terms of how, for example, iron and steel is worked in order to introduce this very disorder to make it stronger. What in this research that you're covering, what sort of factor? Is it twice as strong or 10 times as strong? How much stronger?
So surprisingly to the researchers themselves, the yield strength of these engineered materials would increase not twice, but up to six or seven times compared to a material which is of a simple periodic lattice.
And there's some interesting applications, isn't there, for these metamaterials? What are some of the applications?
Well, indeed, if you 3D print a material in such a way that it has this disorder, these grains, it will be very lightweight, but also quite sturdy, durable. And that could be really useful. You can use that in vehicles, in cars, to make them lighter whilst you make them still be durable and safe, or in aerospace, and yeah, it goes on.
And another thing you mentioned when we were talking about this earlier is that you could actually learn something about real materials, traditional materials, because you could actually use this technique to build a model of a material and then study it.
So yeah, you can, if you have, you can build these materials very complex-like, and once you've built it, you know exactly what, how you've constructed it. You know where the grains are and how they're oriented. So when you test this material under heavy stress, you know how it reacts, so you can model different phenomena which are known in metallurgy. And that is quite interesting. You can figure out what structure types are responsible for which properties in materials.
And this work was done by researchers in the UK, is that right?
Yes. It was people from Imperial and Sheffield.
Okay, so thanks, Alex. And keep an eye out for Alex's news story, which will appear on Physics World. And welcome to the team. And I'm sure you're going to see a lot more on the Physics World website from Alex in the future.
Thank you, Hamish. Thank you for having me.
Now James is back to talk about an interview that we've done recently.
That's right, Hamish. Yeah, so this is an interview from the end of last year. So we had a visit to our offices here at IP Publishing from... It was a couple of people who were part of the Society for Radiological Protection. So it's the current president, Amber Bannon, who works for the Environment Agency, and the incoming president, Peter Bryant, who will become the president later this year. He works for EDF Energy. So basically, they were visiting the offices because our company, IP Publishing, which publishes Physics World, also produces a journal on behalf of that society, so the Journal of Radiological Protection. And it's been 30 years now that we've had that partnership. So those guys came into the office. One of our colleagues baked them a lovely cake as well to celebrate that 30th birthday.
Oh, I heard about the cake, yeah. Was it yellow, like a radiation sign?
Bright yellow, yeah.
I don't think I got a piece, actually. I'm not sure what happened there.
It was quite a big cake, but yeah, these things tend to get whisked off to other colleagues. So. Mm. But yeah, that was a nice cake. And while they were here, our editor, the editor of Physics World, Mateen Durrani, sat down with Amber and Peter and spoke a little bit about what the society does and also just the different areas that are covered by radiological protection. So it's more varied than I realised. I mean, medicine is quite a common one where you have to deal with lots of radioactive isotopes, but also in lots of building materials contain natural radiation. So this the need for this work stretches across lots of different areas. So Amber and Peter spoke about careers and the different skills that are required for a career in radiological protection. And they're also very used to dealing with the public, and they're well aware of some of the conceptions around radiation. In fact, it's quite politically sensitive. So they spoke a bit about, for example, they had to deal with the media in high profile cases, such as the death of Alexander Litvinenko a few years ago, the former Russian agent who was poisoned with polonium-210. And they make very clear as well that they're a politically neutral organisation, But we couldn't obviously let this podcast go by without mentioning the B word, Brexit, which has obviously dominated the news this week. But in that interview with Mateen, they speak a bit about the challenges around Brexit, not least the fact that lots of the radiation standards here in the UK are aligned with EU regulations. So they've obviously, since the Brexit vote in 2016, they've been working closely with the UK government to have a plan, basically, for after Brexit, if indeed it does happen. So I'll pass over now to Mateen with that interview from the end of last year.
So, Amber, you work at the Environment Agency. What's your job there?
I'm a regulator. I'm a technical specialist for radioactive substances regulation. Any organisation that wants to use radioactive material or generate radioactive waste, they need a permit from the Environment Agency. I specialise in the non-nuclear field, so things like hospitals, universities, R&D facilities, and my particular specialism is the medical sector and R&D.
Right. So you're a chemist by training, but Peter, you're a physicist and you're at EDF Energy. What's your job there?
So I work within the nuclear new build part of EDF, which is currently building Hinkley Point C. My particular role is anything to do with radiation. So that's anything from designing the emergency arrangements for what would happen if there was some kind of incident, or looking at the design of the actual reactor for shielding properties, or how we're going to manage any radioactive waste generated, but also minimising the quantities to reduce any environmental impacts.
So, Amber, you're the current president of the Society for Radiological Protection. So what's the purpose of that organisation?
Well, our mission, which is specified in our Royal Charter, is to promote the science and art of radiation protection and its allied fields for the benefit of the public. And really, that's all about helping the public to understand about radiation, the fact that it is all around us, as well as the more high-profile issues surrounding nuclear power supply and use of medical isotopes for treatment of cancer, for example. And also it's to encourage people to want to go into the field, encourage youngsters to consider a career in a science environment, particularly in radiation protection. We want to encourage that.
Mm. So how many members do you have at the moment?
We have over 2,200 members. Some of them who are members of other organisations as well, some of them based abroad, the majority are based in the UK, and we're very lucky to have them because they're all really keen to volunteer, not only on our committees, but also for our outreach activities in STEM engagement events.
And you mentioned briefly some of the fields. Peter, what sort of fields do the members work in?
It's quite diverse, really. So it can cover anything from the more obvious ones, such as nuclear power stations, to medical areas. So as Amber mentioned, there's things such as cancer treatments that rely on the use of radioactivity. But also radiation is used in a wide range of applications. So it's used in construction industries to test qualities of welds. So it can be in any type of construction industry. Also, processing of certain natural materials produce radioactive byproducts, which are called naturally occurring radioactive materials. So there's even involvement in radiation protection in areas such as the oil and gas sector or the steelworks, which can be used to produce a wide range of infrastructure, even such things such as wind turbines, for instance.
Mm. We were chatting earlier when I was at a summer student many years ago at CERN. I did a summer studentship working on environmental protection at CERN. I think the people at CERN probably thought I was the only person who'd ever wanted to actually work in that field, but I kind of found it interesting as a student. But as we mentioned before, having a career in this field perhaps goes under the radar a bit, doesn't it? But there are plenty of opportunities there, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. Our members come from such a diverse range of backgrounds. I'm a chemist, Pete's a physicist. We have people who have a focus on environmental protection, like you've said, and have done environmental degrees. There are so many different careers, and I think by us doing the outreach events like the Big Bang Fair, New Scientist Live, it means that we're getting out to members of the public and highlighting the full range of opportunities that are available in radiation protection careers. Some things that they might not have even heard of, never mind thought of applying for.
Probably fair to say it's very varied as well on what you can do on a day-to-day basis. So prior to working for EDF, I worked for a consultancy, and during that time I worked on everything from decommissioning Chernobyl-style reactors to looking at naturally occurring radioactive materials in Abu Dhabi, where there were really high elevated levels just you would encounter during living in a house there. But you can also have anything from contaminated land to medical productions to developments of new technologies as well. So you can have a really varied career and full of technical challenges as well.
So sort of, Amber, if I was a student thinking of going into the field, kind of what sort of skills do you need to be good or make have a successful and enjoyable career in the field? What kind of things do you need to be good at if you're a physicist?
I would say definitely being enthusiastic about the subject, being enthusiastic about physics or indeed any science subject really. That always helps because you want to be able to enthuse other people, get them excited about what you're working on. Having good communication skills, being able to tell people about what you're doing, even if it's just to your own family members, I think again spreads the word about how important radiation protection is in our lives. Because if radiation protection wasn't there as a career choice, you wouldn't be able to go and have your cancer treatments at hospitals because that relies on medical physics experts. So just being able to communicate, being enthusiastic and being willing to put in some hard work. You don't always have to be technically brilliant to come into our field. There is a full range of careers available to people.
So is it kind of quite a sort of practical thing? Is there a lot of experimentation? Do you have to be good at data analysis or modelling? What kind of, I mean, obviously it varies from job to job, but roughly speaking, what would you say?
I think the key thing you really need, and it comes back to something that a lot of physicists are taught through universities and A-levels, etc., is the problem-solving skills. So it's being able to take a problem or a scenario you're presented with. So say, for instance, you're developing a new piece of technology for radioactive waste treatment, you've got to be able to analyse, well, what's the physical hazard we're dealing with? How much radiation are we dealing with? And how are we going to handle it in such a way to protect the public, to protect other workers involved in it, but also to protect the workers working in the immediate environment around it as well? So it does come down to the problem-solving skills. Certain roles require more of an analytical side to it. For instance, if you work in radiation shielding, there's quite a lot of Monte Carlo modelling. And if you work in some of the environmental fields, there can be a lot of dispersion modelling. So there are some numerical sides, but the people that deal with the day-to-day radiation protection are often actually working within facilities handling radiation or on nuclear power stations or in hospitals. And in those cases, it's much more about the problem-solving skills right there in that particular situation, and being able to communicate that, as Amber said, to a wide range of audiences who might not be technical.
So Amber, we're celebrating 30 years of the Journal for Radiological Protection that IOP Publishing publishes in partnership with your organisation. And there was one paper that caught my eye recently. It was to do with the polonium poisoning of the former Russian Secret Service officer Alexander Litvinchenko. And there was a paper in the journal about that. And we don't need to go into the details of that, but obviously some topics that your organisation deals with are quite sensitive and involve dealing with the public. What are the challenges of communicating what you do and getting the science right when it comes to talking to the rest of the world?
I think one of the great advantages of being part of the Society for Radiological Protection is, as Pete said earlier, we have a diverse membership, working in lots of different sectors, lots of different backgrounds. And when something like the Alexander Litvinenko incident comes up, we want to be able to present the facts, the scientific facts, without necessarily going into any personal opinions. And by having the full range of membership, with all their different backgrounds, all their different skills, it allows us to publish a very clear scientific statement about what are the facts, you know, how did this occur? What is polonium, for example? And keep it factual so that members of the public know that they can come to us as an independent chartered society for radiation protection in the UK. They know they can come to us for an independent statement.
Do they do those kind of incidents take up a lot of time? Because I can imagine you've got people who might challenge you and don't understand what you're talking about. Does that get difficult? I mean, you must have to be quite sensitive to know how to handle those cases.
It can do, and a lot of our members from their day jobs, from their careers, have a lot of experience in handling difficult inquiries, indeed handling members of the public asking questions, or indeed MPs asking questions. So that experience really comes into play as well as being voluntary members of the Society for Radiological Protection. They can put those skills to good use.
So Amber, the Society for Radiological Protection, it's mainly a UK society, but I think you have quite a few international links, don't you?
That's right, we do. We are the UK's link to the International Radiation Protection Association. And this pulls together all the different societies around the world and looks at their views, any issues that they're having, and promotes collaboration between those different societies. We have had a lot of involvement with many of those, particularly in Europe, just because it helps geographically, you know, it's easy to get together and have meetings. And Peter and I were in Paris last month to have a meeting of all European the European presidents from all the different societies to meet and discuss issues, common issues and interests. But we also have meetings that bring people from around the world as well. And we've certainly met with a lot of Japanese colleagues, and we've been liaising with the Japanese Health Physics Society to share some learning following the Fukushima incident several years ago, particularly with regards to communicating risk to the public so that we don't inadvertently scaremonger, but we present facts and try and help people understand the impacts of something that's just happened. So we've invited them to come and attend our AGM meeting in May 2019, one of two of their members, in fact, to be involved in a workshop and also to do a presentation. And we're hoping to foster further collaborations with the Japanese going forward. We've also helped the Dutch Society with a recent event that they planned earlier this year. We're looking to help support the Spanish and Swiss German societies for future events that they're looking to run. And it's just all about sharing our knowledge and expertise and providing the additional support, because we are all volunteers. We're not paid to do the society work.
So by May 2019, Peter, Britain may well have left the EU by then. And I know a lot of scientists are not particularly happy about Brexit. So what's the challenge for the society with that happening?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that no matter where you go, Brexit's a bit of a hot topic. Now, by exiting the European Union, one of the other things the UK is actually exiting is what's known as the Euratom Treaty. And the Euratom Treaty, in essence, covers elements of nuclear energy, but also helps set a lot of the standards for radiation protection. So radiation protection legislation in the UK is based under the Euratom Basic Safety Standards. So leaving the EU obviously does come with some challenges, but within the SRP, we've been working with government to make sure that the views of our membership, but also the views of some of the various companies within that membership as well, is represented. And I think it's fair to say we've had some very, very constructive conversations with UK government. And I think it's good to see that they've listened in a number of cases. And also, you know, we're working together for the best solution for all parties. But what's really important is what comes back to what Amber said earlier, which is around remaining politically neutral. So we're making sure that within our advice, we try and take the emotion out of it, because Brexit's a fairly emotive subject. And we just present, you know, what needs to be in place by March next year to ensure we can continue to operate safely and protect the public and workers effectively.
Right, so Peter, you're going to take the helm as president next year from May, I think, May 2019. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So, here's your message to get all those students out there who want to, thinking about a career in the field, you know, what would you say to them if they're, if I'm a student listening and I want to think about this as a career option, what would you say to them?
Well, I think I'd kind of bring it back to my own story, really. If you asked me back when I was in my A-levels, I probably didn't know what I really wanted to do. I knew I really enjoyed physics. I enjoyed the technical challenge associated with it, which is why I studied it at university. And it was actually only via meeting someone on a train journey when I was actually studying, but actually brought this field to my attention. And the individual talked about it with such passion. That's what really drew me in. So what I'd say is, over the last 11 odd years, I've had such a varied career. I've got to see some fantastic places, some real technical challenges, and every single day is different. So every single day I'm presented with a different challenge, whether that's building a new nuclear power station, whether that's looking at handling some particularly challenging radioactive sources. So it keeps me varied and it keeps me interested. So anyone who's looking for a challenge, anyone who enjoys that problem-solving skills and really wants to be able to just have a varied career, it's something definitely worth considering.
Brilliant. So maybe there's a student out there listening to a podcast, this podcast on a train, who may follow your example one day. So thanks, Peter, and thanks, Amber, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode of the Physics World Weekly podcast. Thanks to Alex, James, and Mateen for their contributions. And thanks to you for listening. You can find all the articles that we've discussed on the podcast at physicsworld.com. If you enjoy what you hear, then you can subscribe via the Apple Podcast app or your preferred podcast host. Goodbye. Physics World.